Game, the podcast where baseball fans discuss the baseball books that they love. And I'm really excited today because we're recording our first proper episode of the podcast. And I'm especially excited because we've got two fantastic guests to discuss a fantastic book. And that book is Moneyball by Michael Lewis. So first of all, I'm going to introduce my co-host, Phil Stone.
Hi, Phil. Hello.
And we're joined by Matt Smith from Baseball GB and also the Oakland A's UK fan organization. I don't know the best way to describe you, Matt, but do you want to say hello?
Hello there. Yeah, it's something of an empire now. We're expanding out across all the platforms. So, exactly. Yeah, we're trying to take over the world here.
Multi-continental, multi-platform behemoth that is Oakland A's UK. And also joined by Russell Easom. Russell's probably best known for his work on Batflips and Nerds, and also for being described as the Britain's answer to Bill James by Baseball Brit on the Effectively Wild last week. So, hey, Russell.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for having me on, Steve and Phil.
Cool. All right, well, we're going to kick things off then. Well, probably not great to use a football analogy, but never mind. We're going to start off. Let's play ball, indeed. So, just to get us warmed up, do you want to give us a brief introduction to how you first encountered the book Moneyball and what your initial thoughts were and your sort of your relationship with the book? Because I can't remember reading the book for the first time. I can remember reading the book for the second and third times, but I can't remember when I first read the book. How about you guys? Do you want to start off first, Phil?
So I was aware that the book was coming out because I used to work in a bookshop. And at times when I wasn't particularly busy, I just used to while away the hours basically looking on the forthcoming titles bibliographic database for any kind of baseball book. And I saw that there was a book by Michael Lewis, who I knew because he'd written a book called Liar's Poker about his time working on Wall Street. So I was kind of aware that the book was coming out. And I went and bought the book in hardback, and I think I read it within a week, and then ordered five copies for the shop that I was working in, which didn't sell. But I loved it.
It's probably still on the shelf now or whatever.
Yeah. If you go to, I won't say the name of the shop, but yeah, I'm pretty sure it probably is still there. In hardback, they'll probably be first edition. So I don't know, maybe they're worth something. Maybe they're worth more than the £16.99 or whatever it was that I paid for it. But yeah, that's how I first came across it, and I loved it. And in all the subsequent bookshops that I went and worked in, I ordered many more copies in an effort to try and get it up the bestseller list.
Well, the funny thing is, Phil and I actually met working in a bookshop together in 2006, and I distinctly remember discussing it with Phil in 2006 in the context of Barry Zito just signed for the Giants. So it, I must have read it before then. I just literally can't remember when I actually first read it. How about you, Matt? As an A's fan, you must have been quicker onto it than we were.
Yeah, right from the start, really. So I've been an A's fan since 1998. So that was quite early, really. And I think, to be honest, from my point of view, the main thing was that at the time, there wasn't really much of a way to follow baseball. Obviously, we had a couple of games on Baseball on 5 every week. But by and large, my kind of knowledge more deeply about the A's itself wasn't necessarily that great because there wasn't really much of a way to follow it back then. Although we're only talking sort of 15 years ago, you know, you could watch every game or anything like that. MLB TV only really sort of started in 2005. It was the key thing for me as an A's fan was, wow, I'm getting the chance to kind of read about the inner workings of my team in a way that really wasn't available to British fans back then. And especially kind of, you know, learning more about Billy Bean. I knew a bit about him, but not a huge amount. And then I guess more than anything, it was about kind of the kind of blowback that the A's got because of the book. You know, I remember it was talked about a lot, and especially on ESPN Sunday night games, you had Joe Morgan, who was determined to tell everyone that Billy Bean wrote the book. So it was kind of more from my A's fan point of view of being able to get a chance to learn more about the game in a way you wouldn't have done otherwise.
Okay. And Russell, how about you? You said you've read it quite a few times.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I've never actually bought the book. I've been gifted it to me on three separate occasions, and it was lent to me originally by an American friend in university in 2008. So while I was studying maths, I was one of the rarer people who was really into sport and maths. So I made friends with a couple of American guys, and they kind of got me really into baseball for a while. So they lent me the book. I read through it, and I was amazed to kind of like come across this story of somebody going, right, everything you've done before, chuck it. Matt says we should do this. And as a bright-eyed 20-year-old math student, I was like, this is amazing. Like, this is what I want to do when I want to go out into the world. Probably like 2 months later, I've forgotten the book, moved on to kind of like something else, the fleeting mind of a university student, and then picked it up again probably about 4 or 5 years later. So you're looking like 2012, 2013, when I started my real kick into I'm actually following baseball every day. And I reread it again, and it still left a pretty big impact.
Yeah, well, I imagine as a lover of maths and lover of baseball, it's like it must have just been nectar from the gods. Just amazing.
Yeah, you come across a lot of things where somebody has a great idea, but sometimes people don't get the chance to implement their great idea. So it usually takes somebody who's already inside the system to be able to change the system. So it was really interesting to not only read about that happening, but to learn a bit more about Billy Bean and everything that actually happened to him that lent to him making those decisions. Yeah. Because as it kind of goes into the book, if he wasn't a failure from being like the most hyped player of all time, I don't think his mindset would have been the same to actually introduce this. So what happened to him is so much as important as what he ended up doing afterwards.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the thing that what's one of the things I like about the book most is that it's got this narrative drive, which kind of flip-flops between him and his baseball journey and a recap of the 2002 A's season, which sort of they dovetail so nicely, like Michael Lewis sort of weaves them together so skillfully. I think it's one of the reasons that it's so popular as a book, but also why it's so successful as a screenplay. Talking about how successful it is as a book, Phil, I know you've done some digging into the numbers, the sales numbers of the book.
Yeah, exactly. So I've been looking at UK sales of the book and how it compares to other baseball books. In the 21st century, I mean, it's published in 2003, but basically since the turn of the millennium, it sold 43,000 copies in the UK. The next best-selling baseball book is Ed Smith's Playing Hardball, which was written by a cricketer, for people who don't know, and about his experience. He spent spring training with the Mets in the late 90s, and he wrote a book that sold around about 8,500. So Moneyball, 43,000, Playing Hardball, 8,500.
And Russell, it's still go. Russell, go.
Well, that would be roughly five times.
And it still continues to sell now. Like, just looking at the baseball books that have sold in the UK since 2018, Moneyball sold around about 2,000 copies. The next best-selling baseball book in the UK has been Baseball Prospectus, which has sold just over 200. So if my maths is correct, that's around about 10 times as many copies. Mm. The Moneyball is outselling the rest of the market.
And what about, did you do anything to break down the difference between the film tie-in and the original like, print release?
It's interesting you asked that, yeah. So the... If you split out all editions of all baseball books, then the best-selling baseball book has been, or the best-selling baseball non-fiction book has been Michael Lewis's Moneyball, specifically the 2004 paperback edition, which has sold 35,000 copies. Then you've got the film tie-in edition selling 7,700, which came out in 2011. And then you've got the paperback edition of Ed Smith's Playing Hardball just behind that. So actually, Moneyball is both the number one and the number two best-selling baseball book in the UK.
Okay, blimey. This is, for people who are interested in publishing industry, this is going to be amazing podcasting for them. But imagine for some people, they might just be switching off for boo, as their lights are getting turned off around the world. Okay, well, basically, it's an incredibly successful baseball book and puts every other baseball publication in the shade, at least in the UK. Matt, what's the perception like of Billy Bean from an A's perspective? Sort of comparing what it was like in 2002, 2003, that sort of immediate aftermath period of the book coming out, to how A's fans might perceive him in 2019. Has there been a bit of a shift?
There has been a little bit. I mean, one of the things we've kind of thought about in the lead up to this podcast is about success and kind of what does success mean? And I think the thing is in baseball that really for a lot of fans, success just means winning a World Series. It doesn't mean you've been able to put together a really competitive team over a good period of time with not much resource. It's just about, did you win a World Series? And of course, that's the one thing that's missing from Billy Beane's CV as a GM, at least, is that the A's have never taken that final step and actually gone on and won a World Series or even been in a World Series since his time as a GM. So that's always there. And the same thing, anyone who's been in a position of power for a good period of time, they're going to make good decisions. They're going to make bad decisions over that period of time. And so with Billy Beane, because he's got kind of this high status in the game, the mistakes he makes are always much more prominent and much more picked up by people. So the obvious one being a Josh Donaldson trade, although Franklin Barreto, one of the prospects we got for him, is coming through and looks like a good prospect. That's really turned out, you know, he went on to be an MVP for Toronto, so that really didn't work out very well. The big gamble when he traded away Yoenis Cespedes and brought in John Lester and Jeff Samardzija, that all went to pot when we lost the wild card game against the Royals. So he's got kind of a bit of a mixed record. There are some people who almost use the money ball thing against him and say, well, you know, come on, he's supposed to be this great hero, but we've never won a World Series. You know, maybe he doesn't know what he's talking about. And people generally, I think most people are understanding that we all know the A's don't have a lot of money. So the fact that he's able to keep rebuilding the team and keep kind of replenishing the team and keep us competitive when the revenues would suggest we shouldn't be, I think most fans appreciate it. But there is always that thing in the background of, well, but we haven't won a World Series, have we? So that's always something that can be used against him until the day hopefully finally comes one year, maybe even this year, hopefully, when he can get that monkey off his back.
And what about more broadly in the baseball supporting world, in your opinion, Russell, like as a fan of a team that is not the Oakland Athletics, but more broadly as a baseball fan, what do you think the perception change has been of Billy Beane since 2002, 2003?
Well, obviously, kind of like before that, people would have maybe done little about him. I think that book put him in the public conscious and the rest of the media tried to paint him in not a particularly good light. I think there was a lot of fallback from scouts and every other aspect of quite a lot of the major league teams that didn't want anything to do with this going forward. But the general baseball populace now knows that Billy Beane was probably right with a lot of things that he did. Maybe he didn't go about them in the best ways, but he was probably right with what he did. So I think not many people are going to go out there and say, I hate Billy Beane. I don't think there's, I can think of anybody who would really probably actually do that unless you're a hardcore A's fan who's got this one specific reason why you don't like him. For example, the Donaldson trade or something like that. You could just say he blew it because of that. I don't think any baseball fan believes that. I think he's seen as a smart individual who can do the best with what he has. But there's also some people who think, why has he never moved on from the A's? There's that question obviously rears its head in the book, and it reads ahead if you see the film when he gets the opportunity to go to the Red Sox, go get the chance to not only implement this idea, but have money as well to kind of push it as far as it possibly could. So some people think he actually kind of stays safe with kind of staying at the A's, that there isn't a great expectation for them to actually do that well. So if he doesn't win that World Series, it's not the end of the world. Whereas if he went to Boston and didn't win the World Series with that, it could be the end of the world. So a lot of people in the sabermetric world revere him for the changes that he made. But some people think that he's not taken the hardest option or not taken like to go full whole hog at what he could have possibly done.
And I think, I suppose that it might be kind of a victim of his own success in that regard as well, because I mean, so many of the innovations from Moneyball have been superseded by like a general broadening of the analytics approach or the sort of advanced metrics approach to baseball. And he's no longer seen as a pioneer, probably, I would have thought. And he might be now a victim of that slightly. What have you got anything to add on that, Phil?
I was just wondering whether or not, do we think that all baseball teams have kind of caught up? Like Moneyball was a great book, but was it the worst thing that could possibly have happened to the A's? And I wonder how many secrets were spilled on those pages. And there was a there was a passage in the book where Billy Beane goes to see the Blue Ribbon panel on baseball economics, and De Podesta creates a presentation that was just BS because he was trying to avoid telling the panel his secrets. So I kind of do wonder whether or not Moneyball has prompted other teams to kind of really self-analyze and really start catching up.
Well, I think if you just look at the state of front offices that exist in baseball nowadays, it's a completely different landscape to what it was when the book was written. You can say you've got teams like the Baltimore Orioles now, who they have maybe a team of five or six people who were specifically to do analytics, and that is considered poor. That is considered not enough, basically, to compete. They have gone through a whole overhaul kind of like this summer, where they've taken people from the Houston Astros, who have had a huge thing. The sabermetric world and the world within baseball where these advantages can happen, it keeps on changing where that advantage is. Or if everybody got to the same level playing field, there would be something else that was now maybe not valued at the correct manner. And that has continued to happen as baseball has grown, because of the changes that analytics has done to it, and because of the changes of kind of just the talent that is coming through now compared to back in the day.
Yeah.
And I guess the thing with the book, perhaps, is that although, as Phil said, they tried to spin this BS line to Bud Selig and co, I'm sure the other teams saw the success that the A's were having and kind of knew what was going on there. And obviously, people like Paul DePodesta probably would have been stolen away anyway. So it possibly accelerated the knowledge of it. But I'm sure teams would have made the same transition over the years. Maybe it just accelerated a bit, but it probably would have happened. And that's just the way it goes. You know, as Russell said, the landscape always changes. Things will move on. People will catch up, and you've got to find a new kind of opportunity to exploit to keep ahead of the game, really.
Yeah. I think people weren't that far behind. I think if you look at the 20 players that he wanted to sign in the draft, he said, like, these are the must-have players that we need to get, these hitters and pitchers. Quite a lot of them went in the first round to other teams. So it wasn't like they were complete unknowns that he was trying to pluck out of thin air. Like, how long a draft takes to show whether it was worth value or not, that's 5, 10, 15, maybe even 20 years to work out whether you made the right decision in that draft. Things that he made the decisions on the pitch around OBP, you could kind of see that in a very short time.
Absolutely. Lewis describes the story of Moneyball as about the widening gap between rich and poor, but actually there hasn't been that much of a widening in terms of the gap between the richest and the poorest teams. It's pretty much stayed the same broadly, about 20-25%. In terms of the smallest teams having about 20-25% of the highest teams' payroll. But given the broader implementation of sabermetric ideas since Moneyball, we've discussed it a little bit, but do you think it's now more or less difficult to be successful for a small market team than it was in 2002? And I'll throw that out to Matt.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. I think various things have changed over the years, not least the introduction of the second wild card, which some would argue lowers the bar to get into the playoffs at all. So that potentially counteracts it to an extent. I think the key thing, again, as I said, that success really is about winning a World Series. And what we've seen more of the trend over the past 10 years is that the teams that have kind of 150, 160 million payrolls, they've got a lot of smart people in their front offices now. They've got ownership groups that want to win and know that winning means a World Series. So what they're trying to do is to build teams that can compete for, say, a 6-7 year period to give themselves the best chance of hopefully crossing that final threshold of getting a World Series at the end of it. And so these teams are going down the route of rebuilding. We've seen the Cubs do it. We've seen the Astros do it. The Phillies have done it and are now starting to spend money. And it's the same old thing with Moneyball, where the idea is to look for inefficiencies in the market and what you can exploit, what are the opportunities. And what the A's have done, certainly the last 3 or 4 years more than ever, is that they're looking at this as an opportunity for them, because what's happening is that lots of teams are rebuilding, and therefore in any given year, so let's say this year, in the American League, you could say probably at least 6 of the 15 teams really aren't trying to win this year. So one way you can look at it is that this kind of smart, logical approach that teams are taking creates an opportunity for the A's because it some in some ways reduces the amount of competition they have. So what the A's, what you're seeing with the A's, they're not going down a rebuilding route. Same with Tampa Bay Rays, really. They're not teams that are rebuilding or tanking. They're always looking to see, can we make some small moves this year to potentially compete next year? Because next year, there will be another six teams that aren't really trying to win in our league. That gives us nine teams looking for five playoff spots. So it's the same as anything where the landscape is changing. And although the other teams are getting smarter, that does create some opportunities for the A's to exploit. And we're really seeing the way the A's are trying to build their roster, particularly the way they're acquiring a lot of minor league depth. The A's AAA team is always one of the best teams in AAA because they're always looking to bring in players who might be able to help next year. And that's kind of the way the smaller market teams are trying to work now. They're not so much going down the route of trying to build a big team, kind of taking a few years off to build a team that will dominate for a few, kind of 3 or 4 or 5 years. They're looking to kind of hustle around and to be opportunistic, I think, to try and win next year. Or if next year doesn't work out, maybe they'll be able to have a go the following year too. So it's very much more of a bit more of a year-to-year existence for the A's and the Rays, just thinking that maybe next year we might have a chance. So let's keep ourselves within striking distance so that if everything falls right, we'll have a chance next year. So I do think it's always difficult. You're always going to be struggling when you've got a lot less money, but there's always a way to have a go at it. And that's certainly what the A's are doing, certainly recently, is trying to find a way to exploit the fact that the smarter front offices are going down the rebuild and tanking route.
I think, it must make it exciting as an A's fan because you don't have this prolonged period of sort of dropping down. You think about the Astros rebuild, for example, dropping down to where they're running in the region of 70 games a season. And it was very noticeable that they were becoming uncompetitive quite a prolonged period of time before they kind of got to the stage now where their window is open again. So if the you might describe the A's as kind of keeping their window ajar.
Yeah, pretty much. And it, again, one of the key tenets of Moneyball is if other teams are sagging, then you sag. So because teams like the Astros are going down a route of rebuilding, you know, they're doing that with twice the money we have. So if we go down the route of rebuilding, we're going to lose every time. So it is, and it's also the fact that if you're the Astros or you're the Cubs, during those years of rebuilding, you've still got big regional TV network money coming in. You've still got decent attendances in a way that the A's won't have during those periods. So it just kind of it makes more sense for those slightly bigger teams to do the real rebuild. And it when you get to the rebuild stage where you're hopefully coming out the other end, the A's will still be in a situation where they don't have a lot of money to add, you know, big ticket free agents like the Phillies are now done with Bryce Harper. They're still not going to be in a position where they can do like the Astros did, do a big rebuild, but then they were able to add Justin Verlander's salary onto the payroll, which, you know, was a really decisive factor in them winning the World Series. The A's wouldn't be in that situation to do that at the end of a rebuild anyway. So it's about, I think, Billy Beane and his team are very good at recognising where they are as a team, and that's trying to go down that rebuild route. Because everyone else is now doing that sort of thing, it really won't pay the dividends like it used to do, say, 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah. Russell, over to anything to add?
Yeah, it's really interesting when you talk about the, well, I think one of the main principles of like Beanology or Billy Bean's ideas is the zig when people zag. Like the A's this year are an interesting team for so many different reasons. But one of the ones that's caught my eye is you have their pitching is a bunch of not very high velocity fastball throwers, which is the complete opposite to what everybody else is doing right now. All of the money is going to high speed, high spin rate, and the A's have got a bunch of low spin rate, medium sort of like pitchers, which is I think they've targeted a market that is cheaper or different because it's not what these people are valued. And they think, hey, these are probably actually worth more than what everybody else is thinking. So let's use these for this season. Like they're all on 1 year or 2 year contracts where if the A's do badly, but somebody pitches well, they can sell the player and get some prospects for it. But if the A's do well, then maybe they can boost it with one or two other players. It's a really interesting thing to go. But I think if you went back to your like original question, Steve, I think one of the main issues I have with Moneyball, and there aren't really that many, is the actual question of inequality between the lower teams and the top teams. I think Moneyball was skewed by the back-to-back-to-back years of the Yankees that happened like just before. Was it 99, 2000, 2001? That dominating power horse of a team, which, if you actually think about it, is wasn't even just once a decade. It's like it's a once in more like 20 years, 30 years, 40 years sort of like franchise dominance. It doesn't happen anymore for teams to go two series in a row, let alone three series in a row. So if you look at it like the last few years, 2015, the Royals were below average in pay. The Astros were below average in pay. The Cubs were below average in pay the years where they actually won. Now, with the exception of the Royals, the other two have continued to invest to try and extend any sort of run that they can do. But they came at it with no money. And the Royals came at it with, frankly, being a pretty bizarre and poor team. But they got through the wild card and then they won those crapshoots, as Billy Bean called it. And I think there aren't many fans out there who will tell you that the best team always wins the World Series. That's one of the... Sometimes I might say it's annoying, but it's also one of the most amazing things about baseball is that you can have 162 games. You can clearly say, this team is better than all of the rest. And then they don't win the World Series because that's not how baseball's decided.
Absolutely. Do you think that financially things are on a more even keel now than they were? I mean, for example, well, could the A's have made a Manny Machado-sized free agent signing in 2002, for example? I mean, the Padres, pretty small market team now, and they've just managed to kind of get tied down a marquee free agent.
Well, it's interesting that you say the Padres are a small market team because I don't think they are.
Well,
they,
small to medium.
Yeah, they're small to medium. I think they have a latent potential because they are now the only team in that town. With the NFL team moving out, I think there is a greater chance for them to increase the kind of like the presence there. And they've always, I think the owners have kind of said historically, like, we're not going to spend money because we don't think we're going to win. And then they've said, well, we're going to be sensible with our money. We're going to be sensible with our money. And to be honest, they've now got this chance to be San Diego. Like, it is kind of like it is the Padres or nothing in that area, and it's actually a very big metropolitan area, so it could draw in quite a large number of people. So their choice for going at it this time is a really sensible one, I think, for me. But when you say, like, I don't think every team can buy those top players, and I think money gets you wins. It's not a great thing to say, but most studies show that a higher paying team will on average do better. But you're talking getting to like being consistently around 85 to 90 wins. Like, you can't consistently buy and always guarantee that you're going to get yourself 110 wins. There are always going to be teams that, with a little bit of luck, with some of those prospect players coming through, are going to break into that top echelon of teams for a year, maybe two. So it's down to whether you are happy with a world where you're probably going to have out of your 10 playoff teams, six, maybe seven of them are probably the same each year, but there's three different ones every other year. If you're okay with that, then there isn't an issue with baseball. If you're not okay with that, then there is an issue with baseball.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, because when you mentioned that San Diego probably isn't a small market team, one of the things that would get leveled, not so much at Billy Bean, but at the A's more generally, is that people say Oakland are a small market team, but Major League Baseball doesn't think Oakland is a small market team. That's why they've taken away revenue sharing from Oakland. They, you know, Oakland is a small payroll team. When you look at the area that they can expand out into, obviously they share the East Bay with the Giants, but it is actually a big metropolitan area. There's a big TV audience there. And as with San Diego, you know, the Raiders are leaving Oakland, the Golden State Warriors are leaving Oakland soon. So the A's will be in that similar situation. Oakland A's will be really the only team left in Oakland. So there is a query about when you look at small market teams, is it actually a small market, or is it like the owners aren't necessarily investing in the money that they could be? And certainly with the A's, it always comes back to the Coliseum being an old stadium. And it now looks like hopefully we may get a new stadium for 2023. So I think it will be really interesting to see how the A's operate from that point onwards. Because like I say, there is always this undercurrent of people call us a small market team, but maybe we're actually a small payroll team rather than a small market team.
Yeah, I think it's a really important distinction to make. Not necessarily confusing payroll commitment and actual ability or capacity to be able to spend.
Steve, I want to throw that question to you, actually. What's your perception being a Giants fan and being not so far away from the A's and having a, well, certainly looking at the payroll, like more than twice the size last year?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's
and it wasn't a great year.
No, it wasn't a great year, but I think if you asked, I'm not partisan particularly. I'm actually quite a big fan of the A's, basically because of Moneyball. But I think if you asked fans of each team, would they rather have had the period between 2003 and 2018 as a Giants fan or as an A's fan in terms of that success? Most would go for the Giants, but I think it is really interesting, and it comes back to what Matt was saying earlier about how you measure success. I mean, in baseball is so different from football, soccer, because in football, success is measured by winning a trophy, but there are loads of trophies available to every team. And in baseball, it is winner takes all. But having a successful season doesn't necessarily mean winning the World Series. In terms of payroll, I don't know. I think that the Giants have handicapped themselves somewhat in terms of the amount of money they've spent on poor contracts, but they're starting to address that now a little bit. I'm quite excited by, even though I know there's going to be now a prolonged period of not competing in the NL West, I'm quite excited by some of the changes that are being made. Quite excited by the new GM. And I don't know, something maybe a bit sadistic, but I'm quite looking forward to having a period of rooting for the little guy to an extent. And I know that was stupid to describe the Giants as little guys because of their capacity to spend money. But in terms of rebuilding and getting behind another crop of players that are coming through the system, and seeing that sort of blooms is quite exciting. It's not always necessarily exciting to go and make massive free agent signings. It's not something that I necessarily find all that appealing.
Yeah, so as much as you like winning a World Series, for the next 2-3 years you're actually excited about rebuilding and not winning at all.
But if you go by the Giants as a franchise, winning three World Series in the space of such a short period of time, but I as a Giants fan, if I live for another 60 years, I'll be lucky if I see another one or two. So it's not like, yeah, I don't know. I've had my fun.
I think Matt touched on something which is what the Giants can do. If you have that larger payroll, you can do the sort of more, maybe not traditional, but the recent traditional, get rid of all your best players, get in a load of prospects, and continue to sign free agents each year. And if they do well, you sell them on, you get more prospects. And you can continue to do that. And you can speed up the transition from bad team to good team because you're getting in a load more prospects as you go along. And then if the Giants get within probably 2 or 3 years a good crop, then you have the salary space to then just go, right, who's big? Who can I sign? Because the Giants can have a figurehead player that can really help them sell out. Yeah. And I think
So the Giants can do that, but
yeah, I think it's kind of what you were alluding to earlier as well, Russell, when you're talking about Billy Bean not having moved on and sort of staying safe, sort of playing with house money. I mean, if you look at who the Giants have got in now, in Zaidis, he kind of seems like somebody who is more likely to implement analytical driven decisions, and he's going to have the money to be able to back it up. So it's kind of like Billy Bean on speed. You know, it's going to be exciting to see that. And that's one of the reasons why I'm excited.
Yeah. I don't want to derail the podcast too much, but the trade for Pilar, which is was done a day before we've recorded this, is a very interesting one because that almost seems to be the exact opposite of what you should try to be doing.
Absolutely, but I think the funny thing is about Giants fan base that and I'm speaking very much to somebody who is an outsider. I'm not going to games on a regular basis. I think that within the fan community in California, there's a perception that they should be competing, and they're trying to appease the fan who thinks that they have to be putting out a side who's capable of competing for that NL West. But realistically, they haven't done that for a couple of seasons. They have to be seen to be competing, and that's I think if there's a perception change in the fan base that they're onto a rebuilding process, then that might accelerate the extent to which they can make more sweeping changes. It's a bit of a funny in between period at the moment, and it's easy for me to sit here and say, yeah, just tear down, or I mean not even tear down, but let's start again. I think if you're somebody who's paying to go to games, you know, 81 games a season, you want to see a team who's winning and they feel like they have the right, in terms of the amount of money they've got to spend on players, they probably feel that they should be competing in that division. And you know, I probably, to an extent, I do agree with them. And that's like what you were saying about the luxury that Billy Beane has had in terms of not having to be a perennial contender with the A's, but being able to kind of consistently punch above his weight. So his success criteria is different, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
I think we should move on, just because we've kind of answered a few of, I mean, we've kind of answered a few of the questions. My next question was basically, did the Nerds win? And it was about, in chapter two, set in the drafting chapter, in the drafting, it's probably my favorite chapter. I think it works really well. We're kind of given to believe that Michael Lewis was a fly on the wall in the meetings of Beane and De Podesta and his scouting staff as they prepare for the draft. And it introduces that sort of scouts versus nerds narrative. We've answered the question. Obviously, the Nerds won. If you look at how front offices are made up now in terms of the analytics departments and the size of the departments, it's ridiculous. I mean, I know that I think I'm right in saying that the Astros now don't even have people that they send to games. They just do all their analysis in house from Houston.
Yeah. So they don't send anybody to any MLB games, because the data sets effectively that they get from all of the technology is good enough for them to analyze MLB players. Yeah. They still do a bit of scouting lower down, and they still do some more traditional scouting with college and with high school, but nowhere near at the top stage anymore.
How much can we attribute that to Billy Beane's Moneyball A's?
That's a really interesting question, because the sabermetric world will say they were pushing these changes before. Obviously, Bill James's abstract is 10 years before Billy Beane went about what he did. But it's about what changed the consciousness of owners, because if the owners never changed their mind about this, we wouldn't have these analytic teams, because the owners have got to have gone, is that kind of working? Maybe I will kind of pay somebody to have a look at that myself and make those changes. So I think where the A's and where Billy Beane can be given the most credit is changing the minds of the 30 people who actually own clubs. It didn't maybe do much to actually enhance the world of sabermetrics and what the people were actually doing, but by changing the minds of those 30 people, they made a huge difference.
Matt, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think the one thing in reading Moneyball again for this podcast and also watching the movie, one thing kind of to pick out, especially with this question, is that Grady Fuson was kind of seen as the bad guy. Certainly in the movie, he was the scouting director who Billy Beane got rid of, sacked. Now, in reality, that's not actually what happened. Although there was a big disagreement about the 2001 draft when he took Jeremy Bonderman with the first pick, Grady Fuson was very highly thought of by Billy Beane. He left the team because he went to get a better job at the Texas Rangers. The A's brought him back in 2010. He's been with the club ever since. He's very highly thought of. So that kind of characterization by Michael Lewis of Grady Fuson as the old dinosaur who Billy Beane and the A's team thought was useless, didn't know anything, that was completely untrue, to be honest. And it's certainly the case, you know, it's the same as anything where most teams understand that having you want to get the best of both worlds. They understand that, of course, stats are so, they take away so much of the subjectiveness, and kind of, you know, they just allow you to do so much more and are so detailed with the stats you have now, especially with all the Statcast data, that it's completely the right thing to do to use all of that data to the best you can. But that isn't to say that traditional scouting doesn't have any worth whatsoever. There are certainly areas where it's still valuable, as Russell said with the Astros. they've got rid of the major league level advanced scouts who would go ahead to say, you know, watch the Mariners next week if that's who you're going to be playing. Because the StatCast data, I mean, even the stuff that we can see as fans is amazing, let alone, and that's just the tip of the iceberg as to what the clubs get access to. So it doesn't make sense to send scouts there, but when it comes to going and looking at a high school player, then that still has value. And even at the minor league level, I can think of an example with the A's where we've got a very good catching prospect called Sean Murphy, who's got an absolute cannon for an arm. But the stats showed that he wasn't throwing out runners quite so well last year. So the stats told you something. They then sent scouts and coaches down to have a watch. Because of their experience and knowledge of the game, they could see that his footwork when he was going to throw. So the scouts were able to tell that to the coach and to the player in a relatable way. They were able to work on that to get his footwork going correctly. And then they were able to use the stats and, again, the scouting knowledge to see if those changes were actually making a benefit. So that's where that's really what teams are doing. They're taking the best from both worlds and bringing them together to get the maximum effect.
Phil, have you got anything to add?
No, I'm just in agreement with what Russell said, actually. I think Bean was great at creating a culture, I suppose, at the A's. I think he learned a lot from Sandy Alderson as well. As well as Bill James, but I think I see Bean as more of a, like a culture creator at the A's, rather than Moneyball being all his idea. He was very assertive, perhaps driven by anger at his own career and how that turned out. But yeah, I see him more of a somebody who kind of brought in a lot of ideas and kind of made them happen.
I mean, to what extent do you think that player evaluations changed since 2002? Like, how is it completely unrecognizable?
It's not completely. So, are you aware of like the 20/80 scale, which is used to evaluate prospects and major league players? So, effectively, like the idea is that kind of like where you move up and down that scale, it's like a standard deviation difference from the average sort of MLB player. So if somebody's a 40, I'm pretty certain that's supposed to be average. And so historically it used to be like, what was their hitting? You give them a 20/80 score on power, you give them a 20/80 score on contact, you give them a 20/80 score on arm speed, or a 20/80 score on fielding. From people I spoke to, they still do 20/80 scores. It's just for completely different things. It'll be like, what is their swing rate in the strike zone? What's their chase rate? They still use that sort of scale to kind of evaluate players against each other. It's just the metrics that they're actually looking at now are tangible and not just, oh, as Billy Bean said, it's just like not the ones that are just like, are you trying to sell jeans? Like, I love that comment every time he talks about it. You're just looking at the actual skill that could lead into somebody being a good player, not the fact that they are a good player.
Yeah. I mean, it's really interesting in the context of a really recent Ben Lindbergh article about, you know, he dug up these 70,000 scouting reports of the Reds, and he did some analysis of them and talked about inefficiency of the 20/80 scale. To use a Billy Beanism, to what extent do you think it's still a crapshoot? I mean, in terms of getting a player, I mean, I know that now teams are more likely to draft guys out of college rather than high school, and that I imagine is probably an influence of the book or of Moneyball. But is player evaluation a crapshoot? I mean, I really like the John Mabry story that's in the book. You know, he's traded for Giambi, and you know, they weren't happy with Giambi in terms of his like early season slump and his off-field attitude.
Yep.
And he told, they brought Mabry in and they told Arjal not to play him, but he went on an absolute tear. You know, his numbers relative to the season before and the season after, just, you know, ridiculous. Does it suggest that there was not a kind of guiding hand of sabermetrics and that the analytics driven process sometimes yields no better results than like just scouting?
So there's always going to be people who end up being so much better than what was originally thought and end up being so much worse than what was originally thought. And when I raised it earlier on, knowing if somebody drafted better using sabermetrics than compared to using non-sabermetric things, you have to look 10, 15, 20 years in the future to actually look back on to see whether that was the right or the wrong decision that you made. Because unlike a lot of other major sports, there's 4-5 years of a player being in the minor leagues before they even get to the majors. Now, some of the best players like Bryce Harper and Mike Trout push through the system as fast as they can because it's so obvious that they are genetically superior and they actually will be very good at this game. I think what's happening now in baseball, I think the key area right now is in player development, is removing certain levels of that crapshoot, as in to make it a better gamble than it was before. It's kind of saying that we know how to improve players in a certain way for certain things, which is historically wasn't there. It was just like, you play the game, these are the drills you do, this is how you kind of go through your day, and we'll put you against single A opponents. If you do good, you'll then go against double A people. If you could do good, you'll go against triple A people, and you'll work your way through the system like that. Now with technologies, obviously you talked about StatCast in the stadiums, but for the clubs, they have things like Rapsodo, which especially for pitchers, basically can measure the movement, the spin rate, everything that you really want to know about a pitch, that can be measured now. And there's so much work being done on allowing people to make adjustments, even at the minor league level, to become better pitchers. I think the one thing that really stands out for that is if you look at the Houston Astros over the last probably 2.5, maybe 3 years, they took this technology first before anybody else did, any other club. The only person who maybe took it at the same time was probably Trevor Bauer by himself. But as a club, they embraced this technology. They've pretty much improved every single pitcher that has turned up in the last 2.5 years. They've
cough,
made them
cough,
better.
Pintar, cough, cough.
Well, the Pintar could be a possibility. We could discuss that till
it's perhaps they've used it because they know it would be effective and they were able to understand why it would be effective. It's not an accident. Do you know what I mean?
No, but there's enough to kind of show that kind of it's beyond just like a substance being used all the time. They have improved their spin rates. They've improved their efficiencies.
Absolutely.
Like, and so you get players that were, hey, Justin Verlander was not a bad player, but he was kind of on his way down after kind of like the excellent things. He goes to the Astros. They get him to make a couple of changes. He's as good as almost he's ever been as a pitcher. You could look at maybe this year. Like, I'll be amazed. Brian Presley is a relief pitcher for them, and he's probably somebody that maybe most people don't know about. But by the end of this year, I'm going to tell you so many people are going to know how good that guy is in relief because of what he can do with the ball. And it's because they've trained players to just work on one or two things in a different way to everybody else. And it's really showing.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly, you know, that's been a clear and obvious success for the Astros in the way they've been able to do it with a whole group of players. I think when you look at Major League Baseball and you look at something like Moneyball, you're always looking for what's the next great advance going to be. And to be honest, when you're looking at Major League Baseball, the biggest inefficiency in the game right now is injuries, especially with pitchers. So I think that, I know teams are looking at that, looking at the biomechanics of pitchers and things like that. That's probably the next great frontier. The first team that can really get a better handle on keeping pitchers healthy will have a huge advantage. I think that's probably the next thing that's really going to make a big difference to teams, if they can get a handle on injuries to pitchers, to work out why pitchers, at least understand even more why pitchers break down, why did their elbows break down. Is it something that's just developed by the way they pitch as a youngster in high school? Is it something that, therefore, you know, it's difficult to contain? Or is there something they can do in different routines or trying to change mechanics of pitches to make people more or less susceptible to injury? That's going to be a really key area, I think, over the next 10 years on how they can start using all of this data, StatCast data, in terms of not only looking at the mechanics currently, but maybe having red flags so that the StatCast data can immediately pick out, oh, hang on a minute, something's going on. We see that a bit with velocity. You can see, well, somebody's fastball is going down, so maybe there's a potential injury there. But that's certainly an area where you think maybe the stats and all of the data can kind of highlight some red flags. Maybe there's a potential injury on the way. We need to shut this guy down a bit earlier and things like that. Because that's kind of come in a bit where they've looked at, and it's like most things, it kind of started in a slightly crude way where you look at pitch count and it's just like, it's 100 pitches. You can never go across 100 pitches. That's an easy way to set it out. But it's never, that's kind of just an easy way out, really. That's whether you go 105 or 95, do they really know what the difference is there? That's a good starting point. But to try and refine that a lot more and get much more intelligent on how to prevent injuries, that's going to be a really key area over the next 10 years, I think.
It's really interesting that you talk about the mat. I went to Phoenix this spring to watch some spring training, but also I went out there because there was a Sabre Analytics conference going on. And one of the presentations that was there was by a company called Kinetrax, who effectively have a kind of like a scanning system that can track movement of players and down to kind of like skeletal or muscular kind of like scale if you do the kind of like if they pitch in a location. So you can't really use it on when they're in the game, but if they're training in like a room or they're training in the bullpen, you can have these cameras set up and you effectively can track it through and you can show how similar or dissimilar does that look to the average. And so that's how they can then start to track this information about going, well, your shoulder release is slightly different, are kind of like, now are you feeling some discomfort somewhere? They're starting, and so I think a couple of teams have picked up that technology and are starting introducing it. And so I think that you're definitely right, the how do we stop injuries, how do we as a team make sure that we can either, if we push a player to throw harder, throw with a higher revolution rate because they want that, because the stats show that a faster and a higher spin rate gives you better whiffs, am I going to break somebody if I tell them to do that? Because every time I look at the LA Angels, I'm like, you've got to be doing something wrong because you're just breaking pitchers. It's like, it's gone beyond being kind of like, oh, the Angels, that's just unlucky again. They have to be doing something wrong. It's just, it's got to the stage where it's significant that they've had so many break that there has to be something wrong.
It's really interesting talking about what the Moneyball isms of the future, what the kind of the Moneyball-esque innovations will be in the future. Do you think that the climate has changed so that teams are going to be quicker to latch on to other teams' successes, or do you think that there's still a lag in these innovations coming out and teams having success with them to other teams catching on? I'm sort of talking about some of the innovations that have come through. Things like pitch framing, for example, which kind of analysed really nicely in Travis Sawchik's book. Things like bullpenning, which we're starting to see a little bit more of now. Do you think that teams are more able to adapt quickly and jump on the bandwagon, or getting on board on the bandwagon a bit sooner than they would have, say, in 2002?
I think that really depends on what they're trying to jump on board with. So I think we can see over probably the last 10 years, like the increase of the shift. Like the defensive infield shift is one of the main things which, according to some people, is makes baseball not watchable anymore, because for some reason we want fat, powerful hitters just to hit piddly singles into areas of the base and get allowed to get on base. But sorry, that's just sorry, that's just my own personal view there. No, it's like that took time to get between the teams, because it's that is harder to measure whether that is successful or not. Like the OBP stuff, which was done by Billy Bean, and when you get onto the OPS and changing it to WOBA, when that stuff was introduced, it was easier to kind of say, this is definitively working, this is not definitively working. When it becomes harder, when you make these smaller changes, there are going to be some teams that are willing to go out there and take the chance that this change could work. But there are other teams that are going to be more risk averse that aren't going to do this. Like, it's to me like the Yankees have the perfect team to throw an opener and do like that, do that when they're struggling right now with a few pitching injuries, starting injuries. They have the best bullpen in the game. Throw Chad Green out in the first innings or so, and then let your AAA players that are coming in start. It's like that would be better for you, but there's no, I'm not saying there's no way, but.
But there is no way, because there are cultural reasons why they wouldn't do that.
Exactly.
But that's what I'm trying to get to a little bit. I mean, to what extent has that kind of, to what extent have those barriers been broken down by Moneyball? And to what extent are there still barriers, hurdles to teams who are willing, wanting to innovate, wanting to do that, but perhaps feel that there's not a receptive enough fan base for them to be able to do that.
If it makes a physical change to the game, like as in like the opener or the shift or things like that, it's going to be a lot harder for some teams to implement them if they're not in a receptive world. There are definitely some teams where they can do it, and there'll be some teams where there aren't. If it's something that goes on in the background, which fans wouldn't even know the change is happening, it's really quick. So as I said, like with the Rapsodo cameras, like Houston Astros had them like 2 years ago. Last preseason training, there was maybe like three teams who had them. This year, every team has them. Like technology-wise, they are, nobody's getting more than like a year or two's advantage.
Yeah.
But what? Making a change on the pitch, that's down to you still have managers who are maybe less analytically inclined. You still have owners that are less analytically inclined, so they don't want to take chances.
And is there still space for those teams to be successful in 2019, do you think?
If you've got a good enough team, yes. Like,
or
you don't have
enough money, perhaps.
Or enough money, yeah. Like, we're into the stage of marginal gains. To quote like David Brailsford from Sky and GB Cycling, like, you're making the 0.1% changes now. And if you can make more 0.1% changes that improve you than anybody else, it puts you in a chance of being the best. But we are really talking about smaller and smaller margins of gains that you can get.
What do you think, Matt? Do you think that Billy Beane being a A's figure has made the A's fan base more receptive to innovation? Or do you think that they're just like any other team, they want to see success and they don't really care how it comes?
A bit of both, really. I mean, I think the key phrase that I would use is necessity is the mother of all invention. When you talk about bullpenning, for example, the team that led that last year was the Rays, followed by the A's. Well, it's no surprise that the teams with the lowest money, the people who don't have ace starting pitchers necessarily, although the Rays obviously have Blake Snell, they're the ones that have to try and do something different. So they're the ones who, in some ways, don't have anything to lose or don't have so much to lose. You're the Yankees with a $180-odd million payroll and you start bullpenning. That's probably the right tactic given their current situation. But if it doesn't work, they're really in trouble from their fan base. Whereas with the A's and the Braves, there's a bit more understanding, I think, that, you know, we know we do have to do something different to try and compete. So we're certainly more the type of team that's going to be the first person to do something. And obviously, yeah, if it catches on, people will then follow. But in saying that, even with, you know, we tried the bullpen approach in a wild card game when we started with Liam Hendricks. Because we lost that game, you'll find plenty of A's fans who say, well, why didn't we do that? Why didn't we start Mike Fiers? And I can understand that, but at the same time, it's not like Mike Fiers is Clayton Kershaw or Chris Sale or someone. It's not like we were not starting a number one ace to do it. So it's the same as anything. If it works and you win, everyone's happy. If it doesn't work and you lose, people will blame it. That's the way sports works. That's the kind of mentality of fans. They're passionate, they're dedicated, they just want to see the team win. And, sure, you know, it's an emotional sport and, you know, people will kind of moan if it doesn't work and be happy if it does.
What do you reckon, Phil? Because you're a Sox fan, mm-hmm, and they're probably, I mean, I might think this might be incorrect, but I kind of have the perception of them being, as the, in terms of the fan base, one of the most impatient and most sort of, I don't know, they want success, they expect success. And how receptive do you think the fan base would be there to, or how have they been to some of the changes, some of the innovations that have come through?
Well, I don't think they would be receptive. Matt makes a good point that innovation, I think it's less risky for smaller payroll teams. I don't want to say smaller market teams. That's kind of where I would expect to see the innovation. And like, you know, who is the team today that is most like the A's in the Moneyball era? It's probably still the A's. And maybe the Rays as well, if we're talking about the fact that they've got a small payroll but still managed to win 90 games last year, largely due to the fact that I think Blake Snell is working on tips. He's got a very, 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 very small salary. Yeah, it is the smaller market teams that perhaps there's less risk in terms of fans not turning up to the ballpark if you try something and then say it does fail.
Bill James has said on multiple occasions that he has been told that he is responsible for every single 90-loss or 80-loss season that the Red Sox have ever had, but it's Terry Francona and Alex Cora who are responsible for them winning World Series.
Yeah.
So,
mm-hmm. I want to come on if we can to, because I'm a little bit conscious of time, and we haven't said very much negative about the book, and there are quite a few criticisms of the book that people have kind of put on record. I mean, one of the biggest things is that in the book there's not that much reference of the really successful pitching rotation. If you think about that season, Hudson, Mulder and Zito, how phenomenal they were and how they were largely ignored. Chapter 10 kind of briefly mentions them. They talk about their backstories and how they came to be A's. And there's a reference to how the Padres GM says that the A's did well by those guys because they got lucky, I'm quoting here. I mean, do you think it's fair that Lewis gives that pitching rotation short shrift? Is it that wasn't a good story, that the Bradford story was perhaps more exciting? I mean, that the Hadeberg story was more exciting, was more narrative friendly than those guys? Or do you feel like that Bean should be credited with picking those players that other guys overlooked? What do you think, Matt?
Well, I think it is fair. You know, you look across Michael Lewis's book, and the thing that really comes together and why so many of them have been adapted into films is that he is a brilliant storyteller. That's what he's a master at. He's a master at kind of taking a general idea like the stock market or performance in baseball and then drilling it down to individual human beings where he can tell that story through those humans. And therefore, he was looking for the best stories. That's not to say he was making things up or covering things up. It's just that kind of, when you read the book, it works perfectly. And the fact that he therefore didn't mention Zito, Mulder, Hudson quite so much, I think it can be interpreted as a snub towards them. But I just think it was the more interesting story to concentrate on the other guys. And it's certainly true when you look back on the A's, certainly 2002, that, you know, they were the key players. But by the same token, it was the fact that the A's were able to build a team around those core players, like, you know, the big three and Miguel Tejada and Eric Chavez. They were able to put people like Scott Hatterberg around them, Chad Bradford. That's what made the team. You know, that's the thing with baseball. That's why we love it. It's not kind of like, I don't know, basketball or something where one player can really make a team. You do need a full roster who can all chip in every now and then. It's the same thing as you'll know with the Giants. It wasn't necessarily the biggest stars that got the key hits in the World Series. That's often what you get. It's often someone like Steve Pearce, that's happened with the Red Sox last year, or Mitch Moreland. They're the guys who sometimes come through, and that's what we love about baseball. So the ability of Bean to put those other key players around the bigger players was a very important part of the success. And it probably was just Michael Lewis being the master storyteller that he is. He latched on to what the most fun and entertaining stories of that season would be. And the entertaining story wasn't these amazing, talented pitchers who did brilliantly because they were brilliant, amazing, talented pitchers.
I think that's a really good point. And actually, I think the reason why I like Bill James as well is that Bill James even himself would admit that he wasn't the greatest statistician, but what he was really good was like interpreting data and being able to tell a story from it. And I think that's kind of really underrated value, being able to interpret stuff and get wisdom from quite hardcore statistics. And I think Lewis did it in Moneyball as well.
Yeah, I think just to reiterate almost everything you've said, that there's no story in saying a player was good last year and they were good this year. You can say, and they do say, like, they get a few lines, which can seem, it's not an autobiography. It's a story. It's a story first, I think. So you don't care about the players who performed exactly the same way they did before. So although they were amazing throughout that season, they do lose out. You go that, I just, to quote some fantastic stats that I always look at, is that Hatterberg went from a -1.2 BWAR the year before to a 3.4 WAR in that season. That is basically going, you were one of the worst players in the league. You were minus replacement level, which basically means that the team could have got a Joe Schmo off the street, not off the street, of Joe Schmo out of AAA and put him in that team, and he would have been better than you. And then the year afterwards, you are like a top, like 60 or 70 player in the league, which is...
Well, literally no one wanted him the year before.
No one, yeah.
Yeah.
And you have like Bradford, who was nobody and then had like a top 10 relief season that year. They're the stories, and that's kind of like what happens. And I think the other point you kind of started to touch on there was like, was there an element of luck to what went on in this season? Like, I don't think anybody can talk about the streak without saying that there's an element of luck that goes on to a streak. But if you look at their overall wins at the season, like they ended up with 103 wins, and Bill James himself has a statistic which he calls like Pythag win losses, which is based more off kind of like the number of runs that you scored. Well, if we looked at that, the A's would have had 96 and the Angels would have actually had 99. So the kind of method of saying, well, actually, well, how good the teams actually were, said the Angels were a little bit better than the A's. And, well, the Angels went on to win that year. So there was a little bit of luck. There's always going to be luck or bad luck, good luck or bad luck in any sport. But I think that's what they rode that year. And it was a ride. It was one hell of a ride.
Yeah, it was a fantastic season. I mean, by an extension of it, really, Tejada is kind of dismissed in unflattering terms by Bean as Mr. Swing at Everything, but he did hit pretty well that season. I mean, he got the MVP. I was looking into the numbers. I don't understand how he got the MVP that year, because somebody called Alex Rodriguez had an absolutely monster season that season. Was better by pretty much every metric. And interestingly, like, by all the metrics that were considered to be important at the time as well. I don't really get why. It must have just been because he played for the 72-win Texas Rangers that he didn't get it. But
Plenty of people have done analysis based off like how people, historical MVPs have been chosen, and getting to the postseason is so key that you have to have like an astronomical season to even get considered if your team didn't make the postseason.
But if you're Tejada, if you're Eric Chavez, do you have reason to kind of have gripes that you're not going to be immortalized as much in that book as some of the other guys? I mean, I know we've touched on narrative already, but I mean, do you think they were airbrushed slightly out of it?
I think they were a bit, but again, I think that was just that was the better story to tell. And as Russell said, it wasn't a biography, it wasn't a factual account of this is what happened this season. It was Michael Lewis telling a great story. The fact he did it so well is why the book has been so successful, why it became a great movie too. So you can't say he got it wrong, can you?
No, absolutely. And then on to the other criticism, I suppose, and we're kind of on, I don't know, slightly shaky ground discussing this, but I mean, Giambi and Tejada are both known to have used PEDs. Are we to believe that both Billy Bean and Michael Lewis, who had seemingly pretty good access to the dressing room, like, were they unaware of them being PEDs being used in the clubhouse during that time? I'll start with you, Phil, because we've already talked off air about not wanting to get sued.
Yeah,
but
yeah, I'm going to be really careful in what I say, which is nothing. No, I think if I was player using, and that I knew that there was a journalist hanging around, it's not something, it's not information that I would volunteer. So could it have been kept a secret? Yes, I guess, but it's a hole which I'm not in. It's conspicuous by its absence, I suppose, in Moneyball.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. Whether Michael Lewis saw anything, which, like you say, I'm sure players would have had, well, some players would have had more sense than to do. There was no one around that time who knew about baseball, who watched baseball, who didn't have thoughts about PED going on at that time. And, you know, you could say, yeah, it was an omission. I think that's a fair comment to make, that it wasn't covered at all. I guess he was like a lot of people in that situation, a lot of journalists in that situation, whereas if you really didn't have concrete hard evidence about somebody definitely doing something, it was maybe difficult to, you know, you were putting your neck on the line to accuse someone of it when there wasn't drug testing at the time. So I can kind of understand why he skirted around it, but it's definitely a valid criticism. When you look back in retrospect, it was an area of, you know, quite key importance of baseball at the time that really wasn't looked at all in Moneyball.
Yeah, and I think you touched on it there. I think when the book was originally wrote, we hadn't had the Bulco scandal. We hadn't had, like, I think it's pretty much the time that it came out, like 2004, 2005 was when all the big scandals came out. So I can accept it not being in the original book. It probably, I would be amazed. I would be so shocked if Bean didn't know that this thing was going on.
I think that's it. I think you can maybe imagine that Lewis might not have, but Bean, given his involvement, probably be more likely to.
Being the ex-player, being somebody who'd been in that area and been in that system for a while, like, the people have talked about taking PEDs well back in into the 90s. So it's something that was, I think, a known to players, and it was just something that was, it wasn't, there wasn't a punishment for it. It was against the rules, but there was nothing if you got caught. So I guess some players didn't care. I think the issue that I have is that, as you say, this book has been republished or had a new version since the movie came out. Mm. The movie came out in 2011. I feel that there should or could have been a addition that was added to discuss that, and if that had any impact on the story. Now, if it had a negative impact on the story, then maybe that's why it wasn't included. But I feel that like a newer edition could have had a chapter or at least something saying, well, this is something else that went on at the time that I didn't know about at the time of writing, but has come out to be part of the discussion about what went on at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to start thinking about wrapping up, but one of the things that Phil and I talked about when we were devising the idea of this podcast was that we wanted it to be quite sort of community driven. And to that end, we've managed to get some listener questions that I want to bring in if it's possible for you guys to discuss them. I mean, Mark Blakemore at Mark Blakemore on Twitter asks, what's been the principal legacy of Moneyball? I mean, it's kind of a good question to ask now because it helps us to sort of sum up a little bit anyway. I'm going to throw that out to you, Matt. What's the principal legacy of Moneyball?
Just, I think, the much greater public awareness of the impact that stats can have in baseball particularly, and how that has helped to drive a bit more acceptance of it in the way in which it could therefore be picked up by more teams, especially in a more prominent way. As I think Russell said earlier, a lot of this stuff often was going on in the background, and people are always okay to kind of accept these things if they can't see it visibly in front of them. But I think it really had a big impact on people being more accepting of it. And of course, part of that came when you've got a new idea being so prominently put forward like that, there is always a pushback to it. So there was definitely a period of 5-10 years there. Like I say, as an A's fan, I was kind of feeding that, particularly when, you know, we were kind of a target for lots of grief from kind of traditionalists at the time. There was a lot of pushback, but I think, although there is still certainly some old timers who don't like it, it feels like we've got through a fair bit of that, and now even the most kind of ardent old timers understand that there really is a value in all of the things that sabermetrics can bring to a winning team and to baseball.
What do you reckon, Phil?
Stolen bases last year being at the lowest level since the 1970s. I think that's probably its biggest legacy, right?
you joke, but I mean, there are definitely things that are being taken or have basically almost been removed from the game, and
that could arguably be our things are getting a lot more efficient.
No bunts. just what happened yesterday. We have one of the best and fastest players that's out there, one of the best shortstops, attempting to bunt and breaks one of his fingers. It's just like, he hit two home runs the day before. Why are you trying to bunt the ball?
Yeah.
Like, stats show that bunts are virtually useless. And I was like, and it shouldn't even be considered in today's game. But the fact that it still is shows you that there's work to be done to kind of finish this revolution that Moneyball tried to start. But it planted enough seeds in enough heads that I think without Moneyball, we would be discussing this 5, maybe 10 years later than where we are right now.
Sort of accelerated everything. So, did you want to say something else apart from slow races?
No. I was just going to elaborate on the point that there are certain like statistical categories that have increased in value, and there are others that since Moneyball has come out that have decreased. Yeah, and stolen bases, I think, and bunting, good examples of that.
I think that's an interesting one, in that when the A's and Mariners played in Japan a couple of weeks ago, it was something the commentators picked up a lot on, that in Japan, they're still very much more into bunting and stolen bases. That's the brand of baseball.
Small ball,
exactly. And, you know, and there were several occasions in the game where you could tell the crowd were really shocked. Why isn't he putting a bunt down? And, you know, that's still the mentality of Japanese baseball. And it's an interesting debate to be had as to, does having a game, although not bunting, not trying to steal bases, is the more rational, efficient way to play the game, does it make for a more entertaining game or a less entertaining game? That's always going to be in the eye of the beholder. I think you see that with some of the debates about a shift. For me, I guess partly coming from a point of view of someone who's also a cricket fan, I think shifting fielders makes for a more entertaining game. It makes for a better kind of tactical game. You know, you're shifting the fielders over there, so is the challenge is back on the batter to hit it another way. But there are some people who say, well, if you are tilting the game too far in the way of the fielders, does that make for a less entertaining game? And, you know, I think that's one of the things which the MLB commissioner, Rob Manfred, is looking at, much as I think a lot of his stuff is Looney Tunes stuff. You can understand why he's looking at it, because there is always that balance with any sport whereby, you know, it does an efficient, you know, the most efficient way of playing the game doesn't necessarily make for the most entertaining game. It's a bit like in cricket, whereby if you allowed a one-day cricket team to put fielders wherever they liked, that would make it, that would kind of tip the balance too far in the way of the fielders. So you have to have so many people within the circle, and but then you can move about from that. So it's trying to find a balance. And I think that's something we're now kind of really getting into a debate to, as to what is this, because these sabermetric ideas are so have taken hold so much, where do you draw the line? Should there be a line drawn somewhere? And how do you find a balance? Because there's so much kind of divergence of an opinion on that. I think it's going to be a really interesting way how baseball is going to develop over the next 10 years as to how these ideas are applied, but are balanced out between making, still making an entertaining game to the masses.
Cool. Who, and a sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek question from Henry from Absolute Bunts at LWIMTH on Twitter. Who's your favourite person who appeared in the book? He kind of alludes to the fact that it must be Hadaberg, but what do we feel? What do you think, Phil?
Yeah, Hadaberg. Although whenever I think about Hadaberg now, I just can't help but see Chris Pratt because I've seen the film so many times. Yep. Chad Bradford is a favourite as well. What about you, Steve?
It's Billy Bean for me. I mean, I just think he's an enigma. Mm. I think he's absolutely fascinating character, and I think he's represented or portrayed so positively in the book, and that doesn't hurt his reputation at all. I mean, it's the book is so glowing of him. It's difficult to not read the book and just have this sort of infectious adoration for him. And it's difficult for me to look beyond him. And yeah, he's looks like Brad Pitt. So, you know, I mean, he's a good looking guy. What can I say? Russell.
Yeah, it's probably got to be Bean. I'd obviously have to give a shout out to good old Boris McCracken as well, just getting the getting the name drop in there. But Bean is such an interesting character that it goes beyond just Moneyball. Like, Hadaberg is a great story of that film and a great story of the book, but the book's about Bean. Like, the to hear about like his scouting of him as a child and things, how as a child or as a young adult, and how all that went, it paints such a picture that of how an individual could be created, and I think that intrigues me so much, and I think that's why he's my favorite.
Matt,
just to try and be different, I guess I think I would go with Rob Washington, because he's a player,
good shout,
he's a person
good shout.
Who was featured quite a lot in the book about the way he was able to work with Scott Hatterberg, for example, or the picking machine stuff and all of that. And I think it is something, again, we've touched on it earlier in the podcast, that you can use stats and scouting to kind of bring players together and to kind of reduce your risk and increase your probabilities of getting a good player. But you've got to have good coaches and kind of willingness on the parts of players to buy into all of this. And Ron Washington was somebody who, although he's a baseball traditionalist, was prepared to engage with the stats and to be the conduit. Because I think that's the key thing in the major leagues, is how you can take people who are very well versed in stats and players, and how you can bring those two together. And Ron Washington was one of those guys who could take it in and then work with a player in a way that they understood and related to, and really helped to kind of make the most out of the good stat decisions that were being made on bringing free players. They still relied on the coaches working with the players and the players buying into it. And someone like Ron Washington was a really key quiet person in that regard.
Okay. I completely agree with you. Yeah. I mean, it's been some really nice stuff about his 50th year in the game as well. Just a really nice character. And then very lastly, then this is from Bob Gilbert, who replied on our website, rtgpod.com. And his question, we've kind of answered it, but who's the most Moneyball team in 2019 and why? And I'll open out with Russell.
It's such a toss up between the A's and the Rays. It's like I've thought about this so much.
It's not the New York Yankees, no.
No, sadly not. They have the chance to do something amazing, and they just won't do it. But I'm going to have to stick with the A's. As I said earlier on, they're doing something very different with their starting pitching, and I've got no idea whether it's going to work or not. But they've definitely chosen to do something different, and that is the zig when everybody else sags. That is the true ethos of Moneyball. So Billy Bean's still got it at the A's.
And Matt, how about you?
Yeah, can't disagree with that. I think the interesting thing with it is that with the Rays and the A's, you're looking at the two teams with the worst ballpark situations, so Tropicana Field and obviously the Coliseum. And so, again, the idea of necessity is the mother of all invention. The Tampa Bay Rays situation is a bit more up in the air, but the A's hopefully are making progress with a new ballpark. And it will be interesting to see if both teams, certainly the A's, hopefully will have a new ballpark. There is talk about maybe the Rays might be the relocated, hope not for their fans, but you know, once they get into a situation of a better ballpark and potentially have more money to spend, will that affect the way they go about things? Will they still be as innovative as they are today if they aren't under quite such a pressure to do so? That would be interesting to see over the next 10 years.
And Phil?
Yeah, I can't improve on either of those answers. I think I showed my cards earlier when I said the A's and the Rays, I think, were probably the most A's teams. Maybe the Brewers as well, a little bit. They relatively small payroll, but managed to do pretty well last year.
I love that move in the postseason, putting the starter out for one pitch, yeah, one batter, and then changing them. Like the... I don't know who was presenting the program at the time, but they had absolutely no idea what was going on. And it was just like, there was silence for like a good 20 seconds. And you were like, are their mics turned off? They were just like, okay, let's go to a break. And when they came back from the break, they still were uncertain, going like, is he hurt? And I'm like, I know I'm more statistic inclined than probably 99% of the people who watch the game. But I was like, this was just bizarre, hilarious. It didn't even work, but it just...
But they tried it. Yeah. And that's the spirit of Moneyball, isn't it? That sort of innovation. Or as Matt was saying about the zig and the zag. And I'm not talking about the big... Was it the Saturday big breakfast? Yeah. Crikey. All right. I think we better end it. I've had such a good time. I've really enjoyed it, but there's still so much we could talk about. It's that it just speaks volumes for how amazing the book is and how influential it's been, that there's still just whole things that I haven't got around to talking about. But I am really conscious of not wanting to put out a ridiculously long podcast, especially not for our first episode. But you must both come back and discuss it another time, maybe episode 100 or something. We'll do a Moneyball revisited. Listen, thanks very much for coming on. Just before we wrap, can we hear from you guys on how you can be reached on Twitter, if there's anything else you want to plug, Matt?
So you can find me on MattBaseballGB on Twitter and also on the Oakland AUK Twitter account. And my website is baseballgb.co.uk. This year I'm focusing more on writing about British baseball and European baseball, a bit more than MLB. So, yeah, keep an eye out for all of that.
And Russell?
You can find me at R.Esom on Twitter. And obviously I write for Bat Flips and Nerds, so you can find my content on there. And there's a couple of posts that are on Fangraphs as well. So, yeah, if you just search for Russell Esom, that'll be me.
And Phil?
You can find me on Twitter as at Mr. Philip Stone. And you can find me in the pub in Belushi's once a month when the MLB UK community gets together. And at the London Stadium. At the end of June.
Yeah, quirky. Yeah, it's going to be good. We're all going to that, yeah?
Yep.
Okay, awesome. I'm just going to wrap up then. Say you can check out our website, keep up to date with things at www.rtgpod.com. And our Twitter following is actually burgeoning. It's been a real success story. Been really grateful to some of the people that have retweeted and promoted it. We've got over 250 followers now, so that's like really starting to generate some interest. You can see our Twitter account. It's at RTGpod. You can find me, Steve Klein. I realize I didn't actually introduce myself at the beginning of the podcast, such an amateur, at Bush League Steve. And thanks to everybody. We're hoping to be back in the next few weeks. We're just in negotiations with a couple of really special guests. Just as special as the guests that we've had today. So guests who are on an equal footing in terms of your specialness than the guests that we've had today. No, seriously, guys, it's been, thanks very much for coming on, because you committed to doing it before you'd heard anything about it. But I'm really pleased for how it's gone. So thanks very much for coming on. And we'll get you soon. Cheers. Bye.
Great, thanks a lot.
Cheers. Bye.